Welcome to Discovery, Cedars-Sinai's podcast about research and education. I'm your host, Dr. Corey Cross. Today, we're discussing artificial intelligence as a tool. In medicine, AI doesn't replace the expertise in human caring of clinicians, but rather, it's a tool that augments their ability to provide the best and most personalized care. Today, we're joined by Mike Thompson, who is the Vice President of Enterprise Data Intelligence. He has been on the front lines of implementing and integrating AI into the work done every day at Cedars-Sinai. Mike Thompson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us, what are some ways artificial intelligence is being used at Cedars-Sinai today?
Well, you know, we're using artificial intelligence in a variety of ways, whether it's operational, clinical, and research-oriented. Some of the ways we're using it, we're using artificial intelligence to predict expected bed capacity, how many patients that we'll have in the hospital at any point in time. We're also using it to predict the likelihood of a readmission. A patient who comes to our hospital has a certain procedure or condition, and what's the likelihood they may need to return to the hospital for complications? We're using it in ways to predict likelihood of deterioration of a patient. A patient who is in the ICU right now, what's the likelihood that there are conditions going on with that patient that could cause that patient to deteriorate in ways we don't want them to? So we hit the whole gamut of administrative, clinical, and even patient satisfaction. We have models that when a patient approaches Cedars-Sinai and is admitted to Cedars-Sinai, we predict the expected satisfaction score of that patient because a lot of things that can happen can affect satisfaction. And predicting satisfaction also helps with making sure they have a positive outcome in the end.
That makes sense. So tell us about Alex. So Cedars-Sinai has Alex, which I'd love for you to tell us what it stands for and what it actually does there.
Alex came out of the concept. When we started putting in artificial intelligence at Cedars-Sinai, we knew we needed to collect all data that existed at Cedars-Sinai to feed our artificial intelligence engine. So based upon that concept, we said, you know what? The Library of Alexandria, which we go back way in the Grecian times, the Library of Alexandria was created to capture all knowledge of the humans, all human knowledge across the whole universe, and collect it in a way that could be reused and shared. So we said our artificial intelligence program is doing the same thing. So we said we can't call it Alexandria. So what we changed it to was ALEX, which stands for Automated Learning by Example. Automatically going through the data and learning from the data and using evidence-based practices or examples to do predictions and create artificial intelligence from. And that's how Alex was born.
Wonderful. And then tell us more about how you developed it. So it's my understanding that it started out as the intelligence of a fifth grader, but that's not where it is today.
Yeah. So if you imagine that you're trying to explain to a child what a medical complication is, what an ejection fraction is for a heart condition, for example, what you need to do is start feeding that child data. And we teach that child to learn about what it means to use that data. So we started really easy. Our easy way we started was let's predict patient census models, how many patients we expect will be in the hospital tomorrow. Well, by doing that, it would predict the number of patients expected to be in the hospital tomorrow. It'd look at that and decide, was that correct or was I incorrect? If I was incorrect, let's teach Alex as to why it might have been incorrect. For example, one of the things we've learned that a patient population on Thanksgiving is lower than the patient population 3 days before Thanksgiving. It's a seasonality effects. So we teach Alex that if you're wrong, why are you wrong? And then learn in the future to reapply those learnings. So we said Alex started out as a fifth grader. And it's important that we say Alex started out as a fifth grader, not only because the learning capabilities needed to improve over time, and they need to grow into a neural network that learned. But we also need the individuals who are using Alex to not expect Alex to be perfect. A lot of people at the time we introduced Alex, they expected, oh, you're introducing AI. It's going to be perfect. Everything's going to be 100% correct. And the reality is some models are correct and some models aren't correct. And it's got to have times that's going to be incorrect. So we didn't want people to think it was an expert. We also wanted individuals around the organization who were going to use Alex to become a part of the growth of Alex. The challenge that healthcare has is adoption. And the challenge healthcare has is adoption is because of lack of transparency and lack of involvement of individuals in creating artificial intelligence. So Alex was a way that we can say, let's have individuals work with Alex, give the human knowledge that they have into Alex, look at the data that's existing, why was Alex right and why was it wrong, and teach Alex the reasons why it thinks it was wrong, and have it learn that and continue to learn as it goes over time. Now, that was the early days of Alex. That was the time Alex was a fifth grader. So a fifth grader is predicting census patterns and predicting how many patients will be here tomorrow and how many patients will be admitted and how many patients will be discharged was a pathway into predicting a patient's length of stay. And predicting a patient's length of stay, you learn about the medical complications of a patient. Now, today, we've progressed Alex. In the past 4 years, Alex progressed from, in some areas, is still a fifth grader, and some areas is considered a second-year med student. And what do I mean by that? One of the things that Alex has recently done is reading through pathology and radiology reports, and looking at those pathology and radiology reports is predicting the likelihood that a patient has progression or reoccurrence of bladder cancer. Now, that is really a second-year med student exercise. And Alex right now is performing at the level of a second-year med student and predicting accurately, does the patient have bladder cancer or not have bladder cancer? So it's great to see Alex grow up in these different ways.
And so the way that that progression was able to happen, what you're saying, is by the physicians and the staff at the hospital who are using it, teaching it how to do these things. And when it predicts incorrectly, explaining why that was wrong, or I guess changing an algorithm to make it not make that same mistake in the future. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's reinforcement learning. So Alex is being reinforced with, you did good, and here's things you didn't do as well. And we use humans to help that reinforcement learning. So one of the adoption principles we have is human in the loop.
And how have you found the buy-in to be? Have you found it to be as high as you would expect? Do you still meet some resistance? Or just tell us about that process.
We do. It is human nature to mistrust what we aren't involved with or understand. And highly educated clinicians who are trained in the scientific method are naturally skeptical of any AI that is not backed by hard evidence, right? So if you take Alex as a fifth grader, for example, and you involve the clinicians in the process of saying, we need you to help mature Alex, they're involved in the process of learning when it's right and when it's wrong. And then as they start feeding in information as to why it could be better, they start seeing that Alex is improving and improving, and now it has a 70% accuracy, now an 80% accuracy. And it's that buy-in process that allows transparency in what it is doing. And when you have lack of transparency, you don't get buy-in. When you have transparency and credible data and credible involvement by the physicians, we get buy-in. So there's been projects we worked on where we haven't gotten buy-in. There's been projects we worked on where everybody was involved with it. And the clinician has now taken the model to the clinical practice and taken the model into the workflow, which is easier than having a data scientist saying, you must do this. No, it's individuals who are involved with it are taking it into that workflow. And pretty much, they start to see Alex as a representation of their knowledge and how they've used it to change their workflows and make it easier for them. So that's how buy-in has helped for us and gain trust.
That makes perfect sense to me. As a physician myself, I would say that that would work for me. So I understand exactly what you're saying. Because in the end, as a physician, you have to be able to trust, you know, all the tools that you're using. And when you are part of that process of choosing the tool, and in this case, making the tool, modeling it into what it is you need it to be, and you can see where the explainability comes in, where the transparency comes in, then you feel very confident in the data that you're getting out, and then being able to use that data and explain where it came from to a patient so that they know that you're still the clinician and you're still the one really taking that tool and personalizing the care for them.
That's kind of why we like to use the word augmented intelligence rather than artificial intelligence. The two terms come out of the same realm. They're interrelated. While artificial intelligence is focused on automating processes, augmented intelligence is about keeping the human in the loop and allowing the human to make decisions. And we definitely need to treat the artificial intelligence that comes out of all of our capabilities similar to a lab test result. You have many inputs, and you know as a physician, you have lots of inputs, and some of them could be conflicting. So understanding that this is one input that is helping augment what you already know or might want to confirm what you know, that makes it not only more ethical for us, but it's working, letting the physician work at the top of his or her capacity, and rather than they have to search their data to find the information they would have used.
I love that. And I wish as a society, we would choose to change it from artificial to augmented, because I think as a society, that is what we need. We need tools to help augment us, but not necessarily to replace us. So that's wonderful. I'm glad you brought that to our attention. So I have another question for you. How do you extend these AI tools to other locations and campuses as Cedars-Sinai expands?
We work with, like, for the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, we create an artificial intelligence algorithm using Alex. I'll look through all the data, and believe me, we're looking through a lot of data. We've got 5 petabytes of data that it reads through. We're looking at real-time data. We're looking at historical data. We look at data every 3 minutes. But when it does that, it tries to identify the clinical features or features that are the most relevant and important. So we'll narrow it down to the top 25 or 30 features that are most important to a prediction algorithm. Sometimes it's more than that. Now we go to another hospital and say, we want to try this with you. The first philosophy is that we do not believe that the way that the model has been trained at Cedars-Sinai is going to perform the same at that hospital. It must be localized to their patients, the patient population, the way they do care, the decisions that they make. So we'll walk in with 25 or 30 different features and say, these are the most relevant features. Now let's retrain Alex to learn from your data set and see if the same features show up. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But typically, they're within the first 25 or 30 different features. And then we help them implement and use that into their processes. But our philosophy is that an AI algorithm is not ubiquitous across all hospital systems. It must be localized to your patient population. So we retrain them that way.
No, that makes sense. So I have a futuring question for you. Looking into the future, give us your best guess. What does AI in healthcare look like in the next 10, 15 years?
That's a Star Trek question, isn't it?
It is. It's a fun question. It's where could we go?
If we look at where we think we could go, the first thing we need to do is we would draw a full picture of the patient, a genomic picture of the patient, a societal view of the patient. We look at everything that the patient is doing outside environmentally before they come to our hospital and after they leave our hospital, and draw digital twins about those patients. And we've done some work on digital twins, typically in genomics. But we can look at the digital twin and say, this digital twin beyond genomics, they're living in the same economic, they're living in the same environmental environment as you. And we can proactively look for ways to help people curb what's happening. You know, our hospitals are continuing to be full and they remain full and they get great care. I love for AI to be used in a way that we are dealing with the more complex issues and the less complex and manageable issues. We would not have to have those patients come to the hospital. And you may have heard this before, something we use quite a bit in my field of data science. And we say there's a lot of data scientists out there who are trying to market to people to drink the next sugary drink, the next whatever drink you want to talk about. I want to use AI and see us using AI in the future to help people to avoid those sugary drinks, to avoid the things that might be harmful for them. And that is where right now we have smartphones, we have watches. We're so reliant upon the self-driving car now that I've seen people who are just, you know, going down the road without even looking up. We need self-driving healthcare for those people using AI. And that allows our physicians to work at the top of their license for the things that they want to work on for their critical care and for the things that can keep the patients away who do not need to come to critical care to be managed more effectively.
No, I think that's great. I mean, as a pediatrician, a lot of what we do is what we call preventative guidance, right? So we try to make it so patients don't get hurt or don't get sick. And that's exactly what you're really explaining there, is being able to use AI. You maybe live in this zip code and we know on the weekends the traffic is worse because it's near an arena and there's going to be more cars coming. And so this kid with this asthma at this level is probably going to need an uptick in their inhaler usage. And to be able to like predict that and say, okay, if we give a little bit more preventative medicine, then perhaps we could make sure that these kids don't have an attack or something like that of asthma on these days. Like, I can see how that could work because you would have a lot of data going in and be able to predict some of these things that occur. So that's really exciting.
It's interesting. And a side note on the fact that you had mentioned you're a pediatrician, you would enjoy this little anecdote that we originally trained Alex with a while back. I was working with the children's hospital. If you go to the children's hospital in the NICU, and while in the NICU, the question was, does the sound level within the NICU affect the vital signs of that child? And so then the nurses had an opinion, everybody had an opinion and whatever it is. But what we said, all we need to do is collect the noise level data in the NICU. So we put microphones in the NICU and we correlated the decibel levels of the microphones to the vital signs of the patients. And because we've been collecting all the vital signs of the patient, all data must be collected is our philosophy. We're able to look that gentle increases in decibel levels didn't affect the vital signs, but quick increases like the lid of a trash can closing hit the decibel level that the vital signs did change. And so from that point in time, we've said that data was a way for those little babies to communicate to us.
That's so amazing.
Yeah.
That's really amazing because, yeah, we don't know what's going on because they can't communicate other ways. So that's wonderful. Well, Mike, this has been such an interesting discussion. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your expertise.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk with you.
You can visit cedars-sinai.org/discoveries to read more about artificial intelligence in medicine and all the stories in Cedars-Sinai's magazine about research and education. That's cedars-sinai.org/discoveries. That concludes this episode of Discoveries, Cedars-Sinai's podcast about research and education. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it on your social channels and be sure to check out the entire podcast library for other topics that might be of interest to you. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Thanks for listening to this episode of Discoveries. I'm your host, Dr. Corey Cross.